This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
It's time once again for Time Magazine. Each week, we bring you stories created by a team of national correspondents, from entertainment to politics, from technology to economics. Time Magazine has it all. Coming up on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Time Magazine, and I'm your reader, Mary, with the audio reading service of Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I will be reading the September 29th issue of Time Magazine, copyright 2025. Time USA LLC, and now I'll begin with an article. Actually, I'm going to begin with the description of the cover, which is titled Enough: The Killing of Charlie Kirk and the Epidemic of American Political Violence. The cover on this issue of Time is zoomed-out picture of Charlie Kirk at the rally in Utah, where he was later shot and killed. The entire picture is saturated in dark red hue. Charlie Kirk, a young man in dark pants and a white t-shirt, sits on a stage, and he is in the center of the picture. Above him is a canopy, and in front of him, taking up the bottom half of the image, is a crowd of people. The roof of the canopy is white with the words, "The American Comeback Tour," printed on all four sides. A small strip of fabric drapes over the edge of the roof and is darker in color. It has white text that reads, "Prove me wrong, prove me wrong," also on all four sides. In front of Kirk is a table with ball caps and two binders. A sound speaker stands to the left of the stage, and two bouncers, one in a white shirt and the other one in a dark polo, both wearing sunglasses, and stand on either side of the stage facing the crowd. The crowd appears to make up of mostly young people, all facing Kirk. They stand shoulder to shoulder, very near the stage. Their appearance varies, but most wear casual clothes. Finally, the caption for the cover is printed at the bottom half of the page in white letters, as I have said before, "Enough: The Killing of Charlie Kirk and the Epidemic of American Political Violence," by Eric Cortellesa. This image is associated with the article "American Crisis" by Eric Cortellesa. "American Crisis" by Eric Cortellesa. Charlie Kirk was doing what he so often did, working a college crowd, prodding and provoking students in debate. The 31-year-old founder of Turning Point USA was at Utah Valley University near Salt Lake City on September 10th, surrounded by thousands of students gathered in an outdoor courtyard. It was the first stop of Kirk's fall campus tour, and he was seated beneath a tent emblazoned with the words, "The American Comeback." Kirk became a star in these settings since founding his right-wing advocacy organization at 18. He proved peerless at channeling youthful discontent into political energy, shaping a movement with national reach. As Kirk fielded questions from the audience, a shot rang out, striking him in the neck. Panicked students scattered. Kirk was rushed to the hospital. Grisly footage of the shooting rocketed across social media. Inside the West Wing, staff sat in shocked silence, scrolling their screens to see the latest update. At 4:40 p.m., Donald Trump announced Kirk's death on Truth Social. No one, the president wrote, understood or had the heart of the youth in the United States of America better than Charlie. He leaves behind a wife and two children. In recent years, the prospect of a political assassination like this, carried out before a stunned crowd in broad daylight, has hung over a nation riven by factual fury. Elected officials whispered about it in green rooms and on campaign buses. When the moment arrived, it unfolded with chilling precision. A campus stage, a microphone, a single gunshot. Where it will lead now is an ominous question with no obvious answers. Kirk was one of the most powerful incendiary figures in the American right, the tireless tribune of Trump's young army. To admirers, he was a defender of free expression in hostile territory. To critics, a provocateur who thrived on the rancor of the age. The size and fervor of his audience spoke to his place in the conservative firmament. The most influential voice of my generation as Trump advisor and family friend, Alex Brusewitz, puts it, America is a nation shaped by political violence and steeped in its aftershocks. The 1960s were scarred by political assassinations from Kennedy to King, but in recent years, acts of brazen violence have been the grim drumbeat of a debased national politics. In 2021, the year Trump supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol, there was more than 9,600 recorded threats against members of Congress, according to the Capitol Police. The following year saw a hammer-wielding assailant attack Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, in their San Francisco home, and the attempted stabbing of New York gubernatorial candidate Lee Zeldin in a campaign rally. In 2024, Trump himself faced two attempts on his life, including the history-bending afternoon in Butler, PA, when he turned his head at the instant an assassin fired the bullet, grazing his ear instead of piercing his skull. This year, the threat grew more insistent. The residence of Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, a Democrat, was set on fire by an arsonist. A gunman shot two Democratic Minnesota legislators and their spouses. Two Israeli embassy staffers were shot and killed outside the Capitol Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C. A man shouting "Free Palestine" tossed a Molotov cocktail at pro-Israeli demonstration in Boulder, Colorado. And a gunman who allegedly held anti-vaccine views opened fire at CDC headquarters in Atlanta. I think the evidence is clear that we're at a dangerous point of potential escalation, said Shannon Hiller, executive director of Princeton University's Bridging Divides Initiative, which tracks political violence in the U.S. She argues that a range of forces, the widespread use of dehumanizing rhetoric, the availability of firearms, the spread of disinformation, vanquishing trust in institutions, have converged to create an intractable problem. It's the confluence of all these things that we're living in, she says. And it's why it's so hard to put a finger on a single solution to get out of it. Kirk's path to national prominence was unlike that of other MAGA icons. Born in Chicago suburb, he gravitated toward conservative politics in a predominantly liberal enclave. At 17, He volunteered for a Republican U.S. Senate campaign. He drew notice by writing an essay for the right-wing site Breitbart News, alleging his school textbooks were freighted with liberal bias. Kirk's zeal caught the attention of Bill Montgomery, a businessman and Tea Party activist, who urged him to forego college and dedicate himself fully to political organizing. With Montgomery's seed money, Kirk founded Turning Point USA. He had a knack for finding wealthy patrons drawn to his entrepreneurial panache. GOP megadonor Foster Fries was one of them. Writing a check for $10,000 to help get the fledgling organization off the ground. Republican strategist Michael Biondo was among many to observe how confident Kirk was from the jump. He always loved the challenge of changing the hearts and minds of the youth. He saw them as the future, the turning point to move the needle of conservative politics and principles. Biondo said he took the battle right to the campuses with both his words and his debating style. His impact in this realm cannot be overstated. What began as an effort to rally college students against liberal orthodoxy morphed into something bigger. Kirk made headlines with his professor watch list, which targeted academics accused of suppressing conservative speech or promoting left-wing propaganda. He reveled in provocations that delighted the right and incensed the left. Kirk argued some gun violence deaths were a reasonable price to pay for preserving the Second Amendment, called for a patriot to bail out Paul Pelosi's attacker, helped to spread baseless rumors that Haitian migrants in Ohio were eating people's pets, and once called the Civil Rights Act a huge mistake. The list of people he offended, often intentionally, was as long as his roster of supporters. Over time, Turning Point grew into a well-funded, multi-pronged organization, a media outlet, a voter turnout machine, a hub for student chapters on thousands of high school and college campuses. They're all symbiotic, Kirk told me a few weeks ago. They all feed one another. Kirk was not initially a Trump backer. During the 2016 Republican primary, he supported Scott Walker and Ted Cruz before endorsing Trump. During the thick of the campaign, an associate arranged a meeting with Donald Trump Jr., who hired Kirk on the spot. For the rest of the campaign, he worked as Trump Jr.'s assistant, a role that vaulted him deep into Trump world and secured his place within its inner orbit. After Trump's victory in 2016, Kirk returned his focus to Turning Point and quickly fashioned himself into one of the president's most zealous defenders. He shed the vestiges of Reaganite libertarianism and embraced the national populist framework that undergirded Trump's political project, restricting immigration, imposing tariffs, rejecting foreign entanglements. "It's not a metamorphosis," he once told me. "It's a journey." In 2019, Kirk launched Turning Point Action, a political group dedicated to defeating Democrats and boosting Trump-aligned Republicans. The COVID-19 pandemic propelled him to a new level of prominence. Kirk began recording multiple podcasts a day railing against mask mandates and school closures. He became a fixture on Fox News, where his tirades caught Trump's attention. One evening, Kirk delivered a phrase that crystallized conservative anger. The cure cannot be worse than the disease. Trump heard it, liked it, and began repeating it himself. In the years that followed, Kirk became one of Trump's most unshakable allies. He amplified Trump's false claims that the 2020 election had been stolen and pressed the case for J.D. Vance as Trump's running mate. By 2024, Turning Point was running the voter mobilization drive in Arizona that the campaign relied upon, an effort that helped return the pivotal swing state to Trump's column. By then, Kirk had amassed millions of followers across social media, and the Charlie Kirk Show became one of the most popular political podcasts in the country. He was a one-man persuasion campaign on Trump's behalf, helping the Republican notch a surprisingly strong performance with young voters last November. After Trump's return to the White House was assured, Kirk decamped to a donor condo in West Palm Beach to help manage the transition, vetting prospective appointees for loyalty. When Trump took the oath of office, Kirk stood only steps away. This summer, I joined Kirk in Phoenix, where he spent hours talking as he showed me around Turning Point's headquarters, a sprawling six-building complex, each devoted to another wing of the labyrinth organization he had conjured from scratch. When I walked in, he was dressed in a t-shirt and sweatpants, padding around in his socks and anxiously checking the score of the Chicago Cubs game. He and his aides were deep in planning a fall speaking tour, anticipating even larger crowds. Kirk mused about writing a book on the core tenets of MAGA, but his focus, as ever, was on building a movement that could endure for years to come. He was thinking about who might carry Trump's torch forward. "If J.D. wants to run, he has my full support," Kirk told me. "I will do everything in my power to make him president. Row one, day one." For Kirk's friends and allies, the assassination is shattering, both for the personal loss and for what they fear it portends. "Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be the last, which is why it's so scary," says Representative Anna Paulina Luna of Florida, the first Turning Point alumna elected to Congress. Her words carried the tremor of recognition. In American life, acts of political violence have rarely been isolated. The murder of Martin Luther King Jr. fueled riots across the country. The shooting of Gabby Giffords deepened the atmosphere of paranoia and mistrust. The January 6th attack, with its scenes of armed men roaming the Capitol, enraged the left and illustrated the extreme grievances gripping the right. Kirk's sudden public death risked joining that chain. His killing could become not just a tragedy, but a catalyst, an event that radicalizes even more Americans, less an aberration than a feature of our increasingly perilous national politics. And in another associated article, "The Right to Live," and this is by Gabby Giffords. "I mourn for Charlie Kirk's family. I didn't agree with almost anything he said, but he had a right to speak, just as he had a right to go on a work trip and return safely to his wife and two young children and home in the state we share, Arizona. Just as Melissa Hortman, former Speaker of the Minnesota State Legislature, deserved to be safe at home with her husband and her dog. Instead, they were all three shot dead together one night in June. Just as President Donald Trump has the right to campaign without fear of being assassinated, as two different people tried to do this summer. Just as I had the right to meet with my constituents safely on January 6, 2011, the day when, instead of I, a young congresswoman in a purple district, was nearly assassinated. 18 other people were shot and 6 were killed. Our stories are unique, but what Charlie Kirk, President Trump, Melissa Tortman, and I all have in common is that someone who wanted to kill us had a gun. We can and should talk about political violence and its toxic relationship to political rhetoric. We can and must talk about social media's role in these moments. We all, as individual Americans, need to do a better job considering our words. But anyone who responds to preventable tragedies like this, tragedies that over time become to erode the very fabric of our country, by refusing to face the problem of gun violence and crime head-on is missing the point. What we share and what puts all of us in danger, from elected leaders to little children, like those shot while praying in church in Minnesota a few weeks ago, is the overwhelming prevalence of guns in this country and the loopholes that make it appallingly easy for dangerous people to accept them. In America, we have more guns than people. Many states take sensible steps. Background checks, extreme risk protection orders, and safe storage laws, all policies that help reduce gun crime and gun deaths. Other states like Utah, which year after year receives an F on the annual gun law scorecard released by my organization, Giffords, do fare too little to save lives. I was gutted to learn that Charlie Kirk died while speaking there. And it also is true that in Utah, someone dies from gun violence every 20 hours. Utah has expanded gun access in recent years, and gun deaths have increased along that with that, soaring by 45% since 2014 and more than doubling over the past two decades, according to the CDC. Too many know the pain of having a family member killed by guns in that state and across the country. In fact, mere hours after Kirk's shooting, at least two students were shot on the high school in Evergreen, Colorado. Americans of both political parties desperately want this violence to end. 9 in 10 Republican voters want to close loopholes that allow criminals and dangerous people to get their hands on guns. Ask parents what they want for their children's education, and they say again and again that keeping their kids safe from gun violence is their top priority. The American people are far more united than their representatives in Washington. That is why 92% of Republicans support background checks on all gun sales, 80% support laws to get untraceable ghost guns off the street, and a surprising 78% support requiring a license to own a gun, just as Americans need licenses to drive cars. Yet, Congress refuses to act. It is physically very hard for me to speak because of my injuries from the bullets that hit me that day in January. After watching yet another political shooting violently steal someone's life before our eyes, it's even harder to find words. So I want to speak plainly to my former colleagues in Congress, both the House and the Senate. Do something. Take action. Pray also if you want, but understand your job is action. Nobody goes to the polls to elect someone to pray for them. We vote because we trust the people we elect will pass sensible, moderate policies that make our country a better, safer place to live and raise a family. We may never be able to eliminate all gun violence, but we must realize that all gun violence is preventable. You know what to do to make our country safer for all of us, and our elected representatives can do it immediately. Come to the table as Republicans and Democrats to pass solutions to the epidemic gun violence that's killing both of us. There's no shortage of policies with history of bipartisan support. Closing background checking loopholes, supporting violence intervention programs, funding law enforcement, including the brave agents at the ATF who catch violent criminals and crack down on the small percentage of gun dealers who break the law, among many others. Above all, prioritize American lives over the donations and profits of gun industry CEOs. When I was shot, my friend Judge John Roll was killed. He was a Republican. We didn't always agree, but we still worked together for the good of our state. Also killed was Christina Taylor Greene. She was also 9 years old and had just been elected class president at her elementary school. Their families will never be whole again, just as the Kirk family will never be whole again, and I hold them all in my heart. I call on my colleagues in Washington to show courage, not cowardice. I call on them to show loyalty to our country and our common values, and to do the single most important thing they can for their constituents: keep them safe. Giffords is a former U.S. Congresswoman. Environment. Are wildfires setting us back on air pollution? This is by Simone Shaw. Wildfires are reversing the gains made by decades of clean air standards in Canada and U.S., according to new data published August 28. Researchers at the University of Chicago released the annual Air Quality Life Index, which tracks air pollution and how it impacts life expectancies. This year's report analyzed data collected in 2023. That year, as Canada faced its worst wildfire season in history, with more than 40 million acres of land burning, the flames caused air pollution concentrations to rise to levels not seen since the AQLI began recording air quality data. 2011 in the U.S. and 1998 in Canada. Both nations had made great strides in lowering air pollution, but the wildfires reversed that progress. The two countries saw the highest increase in air pollution worldwide in 2023, despite both having strict air quality rules at the time. The fires elevated pollution levels in pockets of the U.S. and also changed the geographical distribution of pollution. The most polluted countries in the U.S. are, counties in the U.S. are typically concentrated in California. But in 2023, wildfires caused counties in several other states, including Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana, as far south as Mississippi, to be included among the most polluted. Pollution released into the air from fires and other sources is measured in micrometers, or a millionth of a meter. Particles no larger than 2.5 micrometers in diameter are known as PM2.5, and the data from AQLI shows the concentrations of PM2.5 increased by 1.5%. around the world in 2023 compared to 2022 levels, reaching nearly five times the World Health Organization guidelines. long-term exposure to PM2.5 pollution can increase the risk of heart disease, lung cancer, stroke, and other health conditions. The findings are a stark warning about what could be a new reality for air quality. This year's fire season has been the second worst on record, with a total of 18.5 million acres burned since the beginning of 2025. Climate change is causing an increase in the frequency and intensity of wildfires, with the largest spikes occurring in the western U.S. and the boreal forests of northern North America and Russia, according to a NASA study. This change comes at the same time that the Trump administration is working to roll back clean air standards in the U.S. In March, the Environmental Protection Agency announced it plans to undo landmark pollution standards, including the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, which regulate harmful pollutants like particulate matter. The administration also proposed revoking the 2009 endangerment finding, which determined that greenhouse gases were a threat to public health and provided a legal basis for regulating them under the Clean Air Act. Researchers say that the climate change and air pollution are deeply linked, and that lower carbon monoxide emissions, which raise global temperatures and worsen wildfires, is an essential part of reducing air pollution. Both climate change and air pollution are driven by the same source: fossil fuel, combustion from vehicles, power plants, and industry. Researchers spoke in the report, "In this respect, reduction in fossil fuel consumption have the potential to decrease air pollution concentrations and the risks of disruptive climate change." What genocide scholars see in Gaza. On August 31st, the International Association of Genocide Scholars, the IAGS, became the latest organization to address the question of whether Israel's policies and actions in Gaza meet the legal definition of genocide. The government of Israel has engaged in systematic and widespread crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide, read their resolution, which 86% of members approved. The IAGS resolution cited Article 2 of the United Nations Convention for the Prevention and Punishment of Crime of Genocide, which defines genocide as a crime committed with the intent to destroy a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group in whole or in part. It does not include political groups or what is known as cultural genocide. The resolution said Israel's actions in response to the terrorist attack committed by Hamas on October 7, 2023, have not only been directed against Hamas, but have also targeted the entire Gaza population. The IAGS argued that Israel has forcibly displaced nearly all of the 2.3 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip multiple times, and it cited estimates that more than 90% of the housing in the territory has been damaged or destroyed. Legal actions. Israel was previously accused of genocide at the International Court of Justice in a case submitted by South Africa in December 2023. Last November, the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, as well as for Ibrahim al-Masri, a Hamas leader Israel said it killed last July, and whose death Hamas confirmed in January. Israel's response. Oren Memorstein, a spokesperson for Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, rejected the resolution, calling it an embarrassment to the legal profession and to any academic standard. He added, it is entirely based on Hamas' campaign of lies and the laundering of those lies by others. Israel has previously strongly denied that its actions in Gaza constitute genocide, citing its right to defend itself. Netanyahu, in an address on August 13, called allegations of genocide ridiculous and a blatant falsehood. This was from Callum Sutherland for Time. In world news, crisis in the shadows. Millions displaced, famine spreading, yet Sudan's tragedy unfolds far from the world's gaze. Photographs by Moises Simon for Time. And in the first big picture, a woman cooks in the shadows of former orphanage while children move through adjoining rooms, now converted into living quarters for families displaced from Khartoum. The abandoned compound on the outskirts of Al-Junaynah in West Darfur state shelters dozens who fled from Sudan's civil war. Individual anguish is especially wretched. That has been Sudan's lot, nearly 2 years of brutal civil war, slaughter that has claimed some 150,000 lives and forced almost a quarter of its population of 50 million to flee their homes. Yet this forgotten war has received scant attention from an international community preoccupied with the carnage in Ukraine and Gaza and rising tensions in East Asia. That Sudan's plight remains largely hidden is what struck Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Moises Simon when he spent almost 2 weeks in Darfur and Sudanese refugee camps in neighboring Chad. In July and August, a veteran of covering conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, Egypt, Libya, and Syria, Simon hitched rides on UN planes and trudged along muddy tracks to reach the arcane frontier at Africa's beating heart. By embedding with the international NGO Medicines Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, he photographed maimed civilians, grieving mothers, and children conjuring games from the trash of people who have nothing to spare. What makes this conflict unique is the fact that it's in the shadows, said Simon. This huge civil war is having such a deep humanitarian consequences, but has not been given the attention it deserves. It's a conflict that officially began in April of 2023 when a vicious power struggle erupted between Sudan's armed forces and its powerful Rapid Support Forces, RSF, paramilitary group. But the underlying tribal, religious, and political tensions have simmered for decades. Many of the tens of thousands who fled to Abu Tenyu refugee in eastern Chad belonged to Sudan's Masalit ethnic group, whose slaughter by militias aligned with the RSF was declared a genocide by the U.S. in January, echoing an earlier genocide designation in 2004. Simon documented how limited access to clean water, shortages of food, and overstretched health services compound the trauma of displacement. Meanwhile, the onset of the rainy season has exacerbated already deplorable conditions, transforming dust into thick, sludge, flooding fragile shelters and bringing swarms of malaria-carrying mosquitoes. Recent aid cuts have deepened the hardship for families. Relief organizations estimate that the Trump administration's slashing of U.S. aid has shuttered 4 of every 5 emergency food kitchens catering to displaced Sudanese. The UN estimates 7 million women and girls in Sudan have lost access to essential reproduction health services, leading to a spike in stillborns, preventable maternal deaths, and newborn mortality. Saman photographed 24-year-old Khadija, who uses an alias for security, and fled the capital, Khartoum, while 8 months pregnant. "We escaped as explosions hit near our house," she told him. "We left with nothing." Khadija underwent a clandestine cesarean in a makeshift clinic, only for her baby to die hours later. By traveling across the border into RSF-controlled western Darfur, Saman also met rebel combatants and captured the sorrows of their wounded fighters and bereaved kin. "What I found interesting is the parallels in how the civilian population is suffering," says Saman. "Be it families aligned with the RSF or fleeing the RSF, they find themselves displaced, under a lot of stress, without access to proper food, medical attention, or shelter. It speaks to how this war is affecting everybody. Sadly, it also is a conflict without any glimmer of resolution. For while historic animosities fuel the fighting, Sudan is yet another proxy conflict between the Middle East squabbling theocracies, with Qatar and Iran major backers of the Sudanese government, and the UAE bankrolling the RSF, according to UN sanction monitors. Abu Dhabi steadfastly denies stoking the bloodshed. The grim irony of Sudan's predicament is that Africa's third largest country boasts significant mineral reserves, including huge quantities of gold, as well as vast swaths of arable land. Yet foreign powers feuding over these precious resources have destroyed countless lives, as well as any hope of a prosperous future. Adds Saman, "These are people that just want to survive until tomorrow." This is by Charlie Campbell. Time. Time's Latino Leaders. The first one is Daniel Lubetzky, Investing in Change. Daniel Lubetzky, the Mexican-American businessman who turned Kind snack bars into a global powerhouse, started his first company right out of law school, a joint venture between Israelis, Palestinians, Jordanians, Egyptians, and Turks to produce and distribute a line of spreadable pastes. "Trade among people breaks stereotypes," said Lubetzky, 57, who is now perhaps best known as being one of the sharks on ABC's Shark Tank. "It cements relations between people." A second is Ignacio "Nacho" Jimenez, shaking up the cocktail scene. Even as a kid growing up in León, Mexico, Ignacio "Nacho" Jimenez loved food, but he didn't consider it a career path until he moved to the U.S. and started working in restaurants. Still, as he navigated the industry, he found that prestigious establishments didn't take him seriously. Back then, working in a Mexican restaurant didn't mean a thing in terms of experience, said Jimenez, 47, and I had a Mexican accent as well. He kept at it, though, and eventually he began looking for ways to connect to his roots through his work. "I hadn't really explored that part of myself," he said. "I'd kind of been hiding it away in order for me to be accepted." Today, he runs Super Bueno, a Mexican-American cocktail bar in New York City. In June, he won the James Beard Award for Outstanding Professional in Cocktail Service, which he calls validation for his hard work. "I always wanted to challenge the way that we looked at Mexican food culture and the way that you think we do things," he said. "So my menu is designed with that intention." Daphne Frias, climate storyteller. Daphne Frias, who lives with cerebral palsy and uses a wheelchair for mobility, has highlighted her own experiences and those of her local community to advocate for climate and public health solutions that are inclusive of everyone. She tells the story, for instance, of growing up in a Dominican family in West Harlem and commuting from her predominantly Spanish-speaking immigrant neighborhood to downtown Manhattan for school. "I even saw the differences in air quality," said Frias, now 27. "I would wake up in the morning and it would be really hazy and foggy, and then when we got downtown, the air would clear up." Last fall, she joined the conversation with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres about the importance of listening to youth voices. In 2023, she served as lead accessibility consultant for the March to End Fossil Fuels. "The more we continue to silo disability and climate," she says, "the further we will actually be from creating equitable climate solutions." Lisa Colon Zayas, a tenacious performer. When Lisa Colon Zayas became the first Latina to win an Emmy for Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series in 2024 for her performance in The Bear, she expressed shock that she'd won in a field that included Meryl Streep and Carol Burnett. Then, clutching her trophy, she said, "To all the Latinas who are looking at me, keep believing." Gustavo Ejeki delivers with dignity. In the past couple of years, delivery workers in New York City have won crucial protections thanks to a large part to the organizing efforts of Los Deliveristas Unidos, a collective co-founded by Gustavo Ejeki, a Guatemalan immigrant who arrived in New York in 2004. He started his delivering pizzas and saw how little power delivery workers had to protect themselves from terrible working conditions. "A lot of delivery workers face bad things but think that because they're an immigrant, they don't have the right to speak up." Los Deliveristas has secured a string of victories: bathroom access, tip transparency, a minimum wage of $21.44 an hour. In February, New York State Attorney General Letitia James announced a $16.75 million settlement with DoorDash for using tips to subsidize delivery workers' guaranteed pay. And New York City is constructing the first federally funded hub for workers to charge their phones and access other services between deliveries. Isabel Allende, iconic author. Over the course of her celebrated career, Isabel Allende has published 31 books with her works translated into 42 languages. If that output seems impressive, it can at least be part attributed to ritual. "I start all my books on January 8th and don't and often don't have any idea what I'm doing, she confesses. Allende, who was born in 42 to Chilean diplomat parents in Peru, lived in Santiago for much of her first three decades, but was forced to flee her homeland after Chile's 1973 military coup. She spent 13 years in Venezuela, where she wrote her debut novel, The House of Spirits. By the time she moved to the U.S. in the 80s, she is already a best-selling author. Tom Yamas, reporting the facts. As the first Latino anchor and managing editor of the NBC Nightly News, Tom Yamas knows he has one job. I am a Hispanic reporter, but I'm a reporter. He says, I think my value and the value of NBC News is that you're just going to get the news. Yamas, 46, was born in Miami to Cuban immigrants. Because his parents had fled communism, I think they really realized that things like freedom of the press, voting, being an educated citizen, all these things are incredibly important, he said. He started interning at Telemundo at 15 and has worked ABC and NBC covering top news stories like the Lahaina wildfires, the war in Ukraine, and the death of Pope Francis, and the 2024 presidential election. Carl Anthony Towns, an all-star athlete. Although Carl Anthony Towns grew up in Piscataway, New Jersey, as a fan of the New York Knicks, his Olympic dreams lie elsewhere, and the 2028 Games, Towns hopes to represent the Dominican Republic, the birthplace of his late mother and country he's forged close ties to, having first competed for the Dominican national team when he was 15. In 2024, Towns announced he was providing major funding for youth basketball training facility near the city of Santiago. The arena will also include classroom space. They gave my mother life, said Towns, 29, of the DR. It's only right I give them mine. Katya Ezareta, a space advocate. In 2022, Katya Ezareta became the second Mexican and first Mexican woman to travel to space, launching aboard a Blue Origin rocket. The flight lasted little more than 10 minutes, but back on Earth, Ezareta, 30, hopes to make her influence felt in a far more enduring way. She has become a fierce champion of space innovation, establishing her own foundation, which provides free admission to space camp for kids from Mexico and around the world. She has lobbied to broaden two provisions in the Mexican Constitution so they can cite space as a sector to be prioritized for development and give the legislature the power to pass appropriate laws. There are a few more Latino people that they have spotlighted, but I'm afraid our time is up. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Mary with Time Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service of the Allen County Public Library.